Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where is the line between extending human life and prolonging human suffering? My guest today once counted her parents among the lucky ones. Even as they entered their late 70s, they were active, independent, and financially comfortable. But when her father suffered a stroke at 79, followed by worsening infirmity and dementia, Katie Butler found herself unable to prevent either her father's decline or her mother's new and exhausting role as primary caregiver. Butler shares her family's experiences in her new book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. She joins us this afternoon from the studios of KQED. Katie, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
It seems like your parents had sort of followed all the rules, right? They did everything they were told to do in terms of trying to take care of themselves. Had you sort of been able to assume they would always be okay until they weren't?
I think I was part of a very largely held fantasy, which is that our people that we love and we ourselves are going to sail along in perfect health and then suffer something very simple and like a heart attack perhaps in the middle of the night and just quietly and die quite suddenly and without a lot of notice. And once upon a time that was not so unusual. But now because of the amazing advances in medicine, it's frankly very hard to die suddenly or naturally now. And so many people find themselves in my father's position, which is a long period of frailty and decline.
What kind of relationship had your parents had with their regular doctor, the guy they saw for years?
They had a wonderful primary care doctor named Dr. Fales, who was very much in alignment with their values. They were very tough South African immigrants, and they were Stoics, and they were always somewhat skeptical about medical overdoing. I mean, they certainly went to the doctor anytime there was a problem. And they'd signed everything. They'd signed living wills. They'd signed medical proxies. They had signed all the papers that you're told to sign. And Dr. Fales knew them very well. And actually, I think I could say he loved them. And he understood, because he'd been a primary care doctor for so long, he could see a future that they could not see coming.
So your father needed surgery and was essentially required to have a pacemaker installed in order to qualify for surgery. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, if we could just unpack this a bit, essentially, my father had a slow heartbeat, but it had never caused him any physical problems. However, he was going to have general anesthesia for this hernia surgery. And the doctor basically said, the cardiologist said, well, you'd have to have a pacemaker first so that you won't be running a risk of having your heart stopped during surgery since it is a slow heartbeat. And this was really presented to my mother, who was really the decision maker already at that point because my father could hardly speak. And it was presented as a fait accompli that there really were no other options. And it was only much later that I discovered that, for example, he could have been given a temporary, he could have been given a temporary external pacemaker that could have seen him through the surgery. Or he could have had the surgery in another way that didn't involve general anesthesia. But as we enter our later years, these decisions, which seem, they seem like no-brainers at the time, like, oh, minor surgery, pacemaker, not a big deal. Why even talk about it? And then it was only afterwards that we saw the long-term implications and learned that the pacemaker had a 10-year battery and that we were therefore looking at the possibility that my father, who was then had already, frankly, outlived his happiness, would be essentially condemned to this half-life for possibly another 10 years up until the age of 90. So to me, these questions should not be addressed simply as a medical question. They're really a question of our deepest values and our spirituality, as well as our love and concern for the people we love.
You open this book with a stark scene. Your mother, who dearly loved your father, asked you to help her get that pacemaker disabled. Tell us what you remember about that day.
It was one of the most vivid memories of my life. And in some way, one of the most horrible. And in a way, I think I knew that this was a major turning point. We were having tea. It was a lovely scene in my mother's lovely house. And she turned to me and said, please help me get Jeff's pacemaker turned off. And I could just feel my heart pound. And I felt, on the one hand, that my parents were stuck in a crucible of unrelieved suffering that could not continue. And at the same time, I felt that by saying yes and helping her, I felt almost like my father's executioner, and I deeply, deeply loved my father.
And it is it's such a hard decision, and it's one that, you know, when you're faced with this, you think that even by saying it out loud, people are going to think that, you know, that phrase, my father's executioner, obviously that was not what was in your heart, and yet it can read really cold if people don't fully understand the situation.
I think you're absolutely right. And until we wander into this territory, I think it's very easy to judge people from the outside and think how heartless. And I've actually been amazed by the reaction so far to the book and to a previous New York Times article that I wrote about this issue, how many people have written me to say, I have been in some version of this dilemma. There are 28 million people helping take care of someone over 75 now, family caregivers, and a legion, a generation of baby boomers like me who are being forced to look at a question like, do I say yes or no to putting a feeding tube in my demented relative, knowing that that feeding tube might prolong a very, very painful death process? Do I say yes and no to antibiotics? Do I say yes or no to a respirator in an intensive care unit? Do I say I agree to allow that respirator to be withdrawn so that my parent can die, or my loved one, my spouse? And I think we're among the first generations to ever face this question, because up until the 1960s, medicine could do very little to prolong life beyond its natural end. We had vanquished, I mean, not completely vanquished because we never will, but vaccines, antibiotics have done wonders at preventing premature death and epidemics, at least in the developed West. Mm-hmm. But things that were invented in the 60s, like dialysis, respirators, pacemakers, defibrillators, all of these things actually can postpone death, but very, very few of them can return that person to anything approaching a meaningful or happy or active life. So we're facing moral dilemmas that even our ancient religions really don't have a lot of language for. And I'm really hoping that the book will help people speak more publicly about these terrible dilemmas that we face, because sometimes prolonging the life of someone you love, it may be the loving thing to do, but it may not be the kind or the merciful thing to do. And I take it very seriously as a deep moral dilemma for which there are no simple answers. But if we don't start discussing it and developing some deeper language, we simply defer to a medical system whose default mode right now is simply to promote maximum treatment and maximum longevity without even knowing the family, without even knowing the burden on the caregiver, without even knowing what it's like for that person whose life you're trying to prolong. There are lots and lots of old people who literally wake up every day and say to someone they love or to a nurse or to someone in a nursing home, why am I still alive? I'm done. I'm through. And we don't, I mean, I hope this book like breaks the taboo against facing the fact that this is going on.
I have so many page markers in your book that I can't actually find the exact study, but you quote here a really astonishing study that I think will stick with me for a long time. And that is that someone asked people who have very severe heart disease, and a significant number of them said, and these are people who sort of feel sick every day, I take it, they would trade 2 years of life off the end of their lives for one day of excellent health right now.
Exactly. Exactly. And the question comes up to me, what if we unpack that question, what does it mean? In a way, could we ask them, would you just as soon die in your sleep tonight? You know, of course, we never want to ask anybody anything like that because we don't want to make anybody think we want them to die.
Right.
But we almost don't open the door for them to even be able to voice their feelings about it. I'm just remembering having dinner with some friends whose the man's mother had just died in a nursing home. And 2 years earlier, she had gone on dialysis. And he said at dinner, she didn't want to go on. But we, her kids, were too selfish, and we essentially made her. And he now regretted, in retrospect, of course, it's much easier to see what might have been the wise thing to do. But I don't think we're providing people enough free space to actually talk about exactly like the statistic that you mentioned, that 28% of people who are asked whether they exchange one day of life that was healthy for two more years feeling the way they did. There's another statistic of people gravely ill in the hospital, and a third of them, no, I think it's about 28%, actually, the same statistic, about 28% saying, I would rather die than go into a nursing home. And neither their relatives nor their doctors were very good at predicting what their preferences were.
I wonder, Katie, if part of the issue is that by the time people find themselves among the population you call the old, people who have lived well into their mid-80s and beyond, they're no longer, for the most part, in a position to be sort of actively working. And so, in other words, no one who has felt this way, who has been at this stage in their life, is also actively representing the interests of other patients. Does that make sense?
You mean because they're elderly and they're coping with a lot of their own health problems, it's not like they're going to go out and become activists and say we have to get better funding for hospice and better funding for home care?
I mean, there's that and the fact that their doctors and nurses and children have not experienced this themselves. You can experience it, you know, caring for a loved one, but it's not the same as being there yourself.
I think so. And I think unless you're an intimate caregiver, like my mother was with my father 24/7 for the last 6.5 years of his life. And she loved him, and they had been together for 60 years. I think she had a very intimate sense of his suffering as well as of her own. But even I, because I would fly in, you know, at the most 3 times, 4 times a year, often twice, I wouldn't see all of the small markers of decline that she saw. And I wouldn't hear him say the things like, I'm living too long. That she heard. And so I think it's easy for the kids, for example, to have a more sunny view of what's going on unless they are a hands-on caregiver. And hospitals, for example, have an expression called the nephew from Peoria. The nephew from Peoria is the family member who has been very uninvolved in the day-to-day care of someone who's aging and very frail. And they are the ones who fly in at the last minute, very unresolved in their feelings, and insist that everything be done.
My guest is author Katie Butler. Her new book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Katie Butler. Her new book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Katie, you've alluded to this already, but I think it bears a little more discussion. Your mother, we talk about quality of life and we always think about the sick person, and it seems sort of selfish or unimportant or trivial to consider those around this person, but your mom's life was transformed essentially overnight for the worse by your dad's illness.
Yes, and just the other day I was thinking, dementia really has two victims. It has the person who's losing their mind, and then it has the close family member who's doing the 24-hour-a-day caregiving. And my mother was an extremely vital person and a tip-top housewife. I mean, she was a woman of her generation at its best. And to see her, of all people, overwhelmed was heartbreaking to watch. I mean, she was a creative person. She had a life of her own. She sewed, she knitted, she painted, she took photographs, she went to yoga, and that entire life disappeared. And a couple of generations ago, I think this was a little easier on women who still do tend to be the primary caregivers, because there were more women who didn't work outside the home. And so there were daughters-in-law or aunts who had never married who could kind of help take up the slack and really support aging people and dying people at home. And now so many of us are working and our paychecks are needed. There was no way I was going to be able to simply like fly home and move back in with my parents. I just financially and emotionally couldn't have done it. And I think this, what I noticed when we were going and looking at medical care and looking at these very, very difficult moral options is that the further away from us a doctor was, the more likely he was to judge us as being, you know, selfish or exhausted and therefore trying to make the wrong decision. Whereas someone like Dr. Fales, who really truly knew my parents intimately, wanted something very, very different for us. So there's a terrible relationship between power and intimacy here, which is my mother knew my father best. She'd looked after him and been his partner for 60 years. She knew, if anyone did, what was best for him. And then the people who were the furthest distance, like the cardiologist who'd seen him twice for two short office visits, suddenly all the power was in their hands rather than in the hands of the people who truly cared and were doing the work.
You know, one thing I really think that distinguishes this book from others I've read on similar topics is that you're also really candid here that as much as you had great respect and love for both your parents, but your mom in particular could be a tough cookie and not always easy to get along with. And I think sometimes you write about these things in the aftermath and you need to be so careful. But I think that the realness of that relationship and the fact that sometimes she was just sort of a bear is important because it's always complicated, right? Even when everybody's trying to do
their
best.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she was difficult and I was difficult. We're just difficult in different ways. And I think we suffered from some of the conflicts that are true for a lot of women of my generation, which is I was part of this first generation of women to really go out and have careers. Mm-hmm. And she was part of that generation that just missed the boat and had already had kids at the time when the feminist revolution hit. So in some ways, I lived out her frustrated artistic life. And in some ways, frankly, she was very envious of me and also very dismissive because I was never the kind of housewife that she was. I mean, she was just very, very talented. She kept a clean, orderly house, and she would come visit me in California. There'd be rotting vegetables in the, you know, in the vegetable bin or the, you know, expensive cheese, but nothing for dinner. And she would just be kind of horrified and judgmental. So, but there was amazing healing in the course of the period that the book's about, because I did show up for them. Mm-hmm. And she did see that even though I was disorganized and a terrible housewife, I was better with the logistics and the planning and the hiring of extra caregivers from Craigslist and a whole panoply of things that she was not particularly good at. Mm-hmm. And close to the end of her life, she said, you and I did a tremendous job taking care of Daddy. With my practical skills and your brains, we made a great team. And that's something that in the course of our relationship, we had never gotten to that point before my father's stroke. We never thought of each other as a great team. We were always like both in love with my dad and sort of elbowing each other out for attention and, you know, putting each other down for not being good at what the other person was good at. And so she really learned to love me for who I was. Mm-hmm. And I felt very gratified that I felt truly appreciated by her. And I think it's only in the course of writing the book that I actually came to peace with her. I wish I could have come to a more complete peace with her before her death, but I didn't. But I think that process of forgiveness and recognition of each other's limitations is, it goes on beyond the death itself. And today is the anniversary of her death. It's not only the day that the book is out, but officially, but it's also the anniversary of her death. And I created a little altar at home this morning and put her picture up and my dad's and flowers and lit candles. And I was able to like really, really thank her for the gifts that she gave me in my life, despite all the conflict that we had. And I really wanted the book to be honest about that conflict because we're not angels. And these terrible medical crises, they propel you for a very brief period of time into a certain kind of transcendence, at least that happened for me. But then, you know, the old personalities creep back in, and there you are again with the mother who's telling you to, you know, you've got a terrible haircut and you've got to go get it fixed,
and,
you know,
and when still you're trying need your to, help.
You know. Exactly. And my parents were both very powerful, dominant people, and they were not about to just turn over the reins of their lives to their West Coast daughter at a drop of a hat.
So our phone lines are full. I know people want to jump in on the conversation. Before that happens, I do want to put this out there. There is a great deal in this book about the sort of maddening incentives and disincentives to certain care protocols that's been established, maybe unwittingly, by Medicare. The greatest of all is that nobody gets paid for waiting and seeing or for deciding particular treatments might not be the best choice.
Exactly. I talk about a concept called slow medicine, which is, you know, as slow food is to fast food, slow medicine is to fast medicine. Stop throwing goods, services, and tests at people and slow down, think it through, have some wisdom, because the older people get, the more the downsides of these surgeries and interventions show up. Everything from dementia to hospital-based infections to miserable deaths in ICU. And so we need to slow it down. And I think we need to triple the daily rate that hospice and palliative care services are paid for taking care of people and really cut back on the kind of incentives there are to provide often futile but very, very expensive high-tech care in the last year of life. A quarter of Medicare's budget goes for the last year of life.
And I guess what happens is people look at this, and we're not accusing, and you certainly in the book are not accusing all doctors of operating according to greed, but what happens is people say, well, it's covered, so maybe we should try this. And it doesn't necessarily buy any health.
Well, exactly. And doctors are laboring under this terrible system, where they have 15 minutes to see somebody or to make a decision, or they don't know somebody, or that someone shows up in the emergency room. They have no idea who that family is, who the person is. I've heard doctors talk to me about being forced to give CPR to an aging person in an emergency room with the person saying, please don't do this to me, and the family insisting. Okay? So this is not simple. There's an ignorance about the coming of death that collides with this high-tech medicine and this terrible reimbursement system. I mean, basically, doctors are paid not for their time, but for what they do. So a cardiologist will make $450,000 or more, and the family doctor who really, really knows the patient will earn about $150,000. This is terrible. So this is one of the huge surprises I discovered when writing the book and researching my parents' medical records, was that if you're a doctor and you prescribe an expensive chemotherapy, you get not only your fee, but you get 6% of the price of the chemo. So you're actually incentivized to provide the most expensive chemo and to continue providing chemo even when chemo is a futile and actually a very painful, harrowing experience. But if you sit down with someone for an hour and ask them, explain where things are really at and have this incredibly difficult conversation, you'll be hardly paid at all. So you're actually financially punishing doctors for trying to do the right thing, and you are rewarding them if they provide inappropriate, high-tech, very, very expensive medical care, like, for example, a defibrillator that costs $35,000 to put in and $25,000 a year to maintain, and may only give someone perhaps an extra year of life, and in fact may even subject them to a very harrowing death when the defibrillator goes off on the deathbed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Michael in Frisco. Hi, Michael. Michael, are you with us? Okay, we will move on and speak instead with Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Chris. Listen, my father is 91 years old, and up until about 6 months ago, I think he was doing relatively well and I think relatively happy. But it's getting bad now, and I'm thinking about how this is going to go down, and I have no way of knowing, because he's in congestive heart failure, but you wouldn't really know it to look at him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're giving him the Lasix to drain the water off, so we're constantly fighting that.
Yeah.
But he's gotten to the point where he can barely walk now, so he's just stopped going to church. He can still drive when he wants to, but he's got the I don't want to's. I actually heard from his barber when we called to invite her to the 90th birthday party that he had said that he was ready to die. So I guess when I'm trying to think about what to do to prevent any prolonged agony for my dad, and getting to sign, you know, a living will. I find that a very difficult thing to do, but I can do it with him. But I'm thinking about things like, okay, something happens, and someone calls the ambulance.
Yes. Yeah.
How do I go about? I mean, they're going to immediately resuscitate him.
Yeah. What can you tell us about that, Katie?
First of all, my recommendation is that you try to get connected with a palliative care program or a hospice program. Many people with congestive heart failure qualify for hospice. But a doctor, your cardiologist, is not duty-bound to refer you to hospice if he doesn't like the hospice philosophy. So it's up to you to ask for and insist. And we found that as soon as we got into those systems, it was such a relief. People came to the house. They helped with the family. They helped with the huge psychological, emotional, spiritual issues that arise when you do face your own death. And it sounds like your dad is ready to begin that process, which means you have a chance now to tell him everything you're grateful for that he gave you in the course of your life. You have a chance to reconcile or to clear up things or to apologize or to accept an apology. And so there's a shift between how do I make my father live as long as possible to how do I make sure my father is on the path to a good death, a meaningful death. I mean, I don't think death is ever easy for any of us, but you can make it less bad than it has to be. And it sounds like you're asking all the right questions. I think palliative care is probably the most important thing. I also have a Facebook page called Slow Medicine, which has a number of people on it who are in the position that you're in. I also have a resource page on my website called katiebutler.com. I'd like to recommend someone else's book. It's called My Mother, Your Mother by Dr. Dennis McCullough, and it's a beautiful guide to some of the questions we're all facing. And then there's my book, which is called Knocking on Heaven's Door. I should say that too.
Well, what do you, I mean, so many times people get to a place where they sort of understand what the situation is. And it sounds like Bob is there with regard to his father. But as you mentioned, you know, what is it, the nephew from Topeka, Peoria?
Peoria,
yeah.
Yes.
There's someone who disagrees or says, well, that sounds awful, or, you know, he's still getting around. And how do you, I mean, is it possible for families to communicate about this in ways that are not disruptive to other relationships?
This is so tough. It's so tough because we don't want to really face it and talk about it until the crisis is upon us. Mm-hmm. And in the crisis, everybody's brain kind of narrows down and the adrenaline rushes, and often people are at their worst.
Yeah.
And so every family conflict that hasn't been resolved is suddenly bubbling to the surface. I think I was very lucky because I had the example of my mother, who, after seeing what my father went through, she refused open heart surgery. She refused to get her valves replaced. And she had 5 months where she pretty much knew that she was going to die within 2 years. And she died even quicker than that. So she had a lot of time to sort of do the cleanup work and face everything and actually do some reconciliation work with one of my brothers. All I know is that if you're the family member that is the one that's gifted with being able to see the future that's coming down the road, that the more you can bring these issues to the front, the better. Because unfortunately, it doesn't matter if you've signed all the right documents. Doctors will ignore them if there is a nephew from Peoria who could be the person who will sue. It's grim news, but I have to say it. It's almost like you've got to get your family members on the same page, and you've got to have these difficult conversations. And for me, as I said, like, for me, the entry point was writing my father these legacy letters. So I at least was at peace. You know, I felt like I'd said my goodbyes and I'd said my thank yous. So I wasn't in as much conflict as I might have been.
My guest is author Katie Butler. Her new book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Katie Butler. Her new book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Katie, before the break, you mentioned writing to your father at the end of his life. Something remarkable happened with him. His stroke made it difficult for him to communicate verbally, but very often he was able to remain quite articulate on paper.
Yes, I think he may have been unusual. He was a college professor, so he was quite an intimidating character in my life. You know, mm-hmm. He was always at the dinner table saying, "What's your evidence for this?" You know, when I was growing up, to sort of train me up, you know, as a smarty pants. And we had a wonderful coming together after his stroke because he actually became more emotionally open and wise, even though he was less verbal. But he did. It was part of his speech therapy. His speech therapist really encouraged him to write letters. And he actually recovered more articulateness on paper than he did in speech, in spoken speech. So he would labor over these beautiful, short, amazing letters to me, where he would remember things like going down a ski slope on a, you know, one of those flexible flyers when I was 8 years old, are wonderful memories. So we exchanged all of these memories, childhood memories, him taking me to the sea and letting me jump off his shoulders. So we got to communicate love in a way that was open, that was more open than we'd probably been since I was 5 or 6 years old. I mean, we loved each other through our entire lives, but that openness, that childlikeness was an extraordinary gift of the first year or two after the stroke.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Charles in Dallas. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
This is a fabulous subject, and I'm so glad that she wrote the book and that you guys are discussing this, because I think that the quality of life that we've given to prolong people's health is not, is, as she said, makes other people suffer. One of the most interesting things my dad did is my mom had inflammatory breast cancer. And, you know, she was a trooper for chemo for years on and off, but the last six years of her life, she never said that she didn't want to live anymore, but she slept most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my dad became primary caregiver. That's when my dad learned how to cook. He never cooked prior to that. I mean, it's kind of funny, but he says, you know, at least now I can live on my own. But one of the most, and he, you know, we love my mom, and it was fabulous. And she finally passed. And what she did, she just said, I don't want any more chemo, I'm done. She came down to see my kids when I had twins and just never had chemo after that. And then, you know, nature took its course. But one of the most interesting things my dad said was, I'm extremely, extremely sad that mom has passed and I'm going to miss her every day. But I felt a weight come off my shoulders.
I'm sure that's something you can relate to, Katie.
Yes, I can. And I think nobody dies at exactly the right moment, that we all die too soon or too late. And in my family's case, my father died too late. My mother died too soon.
I suppose, especially when you're dealing with your parents or even a spouse, I mean, it does put your own mortality into perspective that it may not have had before.
Maybe so. I mean, I think I'm still in denial. I'm 64. I'm 64. I'm very healthy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I certainly hope I have another decade or 15 years that are good years the way my parents did. My parents really did fine up until about age 80. And I think a lot of people start to crumble around age 80 or so. So my poor partner, Brian, hears me say, you know, over and over again, kind of, take me out to the field and shoot me. I don't want to live into dementia. Mm-hmm. But so I'm very clear. I do have a healthcare proxy who is actually not my partner. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very tough-minded friend, because I'd rather she made the decision and felt the uncertainty rather than the man I love, because I don't want to put him in that position.
So it takes the burden off.
Yeah, exactly. It's better that it's someone a little more distant, mm-hmm. and a little less emotional in their decision making. You know, not the I may be an exception in this, because I think most people choose their most intimate partner. But I decided it would be a kindness to him to not put that burden on him.
You know, what's really interesting, Katie, is it seems that we, based on the calls we've had and the response that you've had to the book and to the piece, I mean, everybody can relate to this, but everybody's also afraid of the slippery slope, right? We're afraid that if we say out loud that maybe we're keeping some people alive too long, spending too much time, money, effort, frankly, human suffering, that we'll be the one who's sort of caught on the other side of it, who wants to live and could be made better, but there's no resources available.
Yes, I do think we have medical rationing now and triage now. But what it is we put people in intensive care where they don't want to be, and we don't give them the home health care, the hospice care, the palliative care, the speech therapy, the physical therapy, all of those kinds of supports that people, as they're in their last 5 years of life, really, really need. So I think we already have a form of medical rationing, because people are getting the deaths they don't want. 3/4 of people want to die at home. And fewer than 1/4 do, and 1/5 die in intensive care, which is not only harrowing and traumatic for survivors, it's also incredibly expensive. One friend of mine's father's ICU death took 10 days, cost $323,000. Now, What kind of help could have been provided to him and to his children to really address the issues of his approaching end if it had been deployed in a better way? So that's my first question. The second is, I think the slippery slope argument is important. And it's one thing to say what you want for yourself, and it's another thing to say what you want for others.
Yeah.
And if others really want everything to be done and they want to do 5 or 6 lines of chemo, even though the chances of it helping have become very minimal, I really say more power to them. But for myself, I don't want to do anything to prolong my life once I have dementia. I really don't want any medical treatment that would prolong my suffering and my life after that point. But I think there is a slippery, for me, there's a slippery slope point, which is that as a medical proxy, as the person who's making medical decisions for someone who can no longer make their own, you got to be very careful. And it's one thing to say, I want this pacemaker was an artificial, tiny form of life support. It never should have been put in, and I want it painlessly disabled so my father can experience a natural death. There's a big leap between that and saying, I want to make a decision for my father that his end should be hastened and we should give him a lot of morphine now so he can die peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that might be a choice I might want for myself if I had certain kinds of brain cancer, for example, but it's not something that I could ever do on the behalf of someone, no matter how much I loved them and no matter how much they were suffering. That's a line I personally could not cross. And I know I've had friends whose parents have asked them to do exactly that.
And yet when you spoke to your father's cardiologist, he sort of recoiled and said, what you want to do is akin to smothering him with a pillow.
That's right. That's what he said. I don't see it that way, and the Supreme Court does not see it that way. In 1989, the Supreme Court declared that if you are a competent adult, you have the right to refuse any form of medical treatment. You are under no legal or moral obligation to undergo any medical treatment, and you have the right to ask any medical treatment to be withdrawn so that you can die a natural death. So cardiology hasn't really caught up yet with a Supreme Court decision that's over 20 years old now. And other forms of medicine have. So, for example, doctors who are in intensive care units, critical care doctors, pulmonologists, people who deal with respirators and, you know, extreme end-of-life care, they have clarified for themselves the distinction between hastening someone's death and removing medical procedures so that nature can take its course and a natural death can occur. Essentially, our medicine has all but abolished natural death. And sometimes it's very dramatic, like a giant, bulky device, like a respirator with a tube down your neck.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's something super small and subtle, like a pacemaker or perhaps a feeding tube. But in all of these cases, we are setting up obstacles to natural death. And sometimes death is a blessing and not a curse. It's part of the natural human existence. You know, it's part of God's plan.
You've said that you wish that you had maybe swallowed your pride and asked for more help from your brothers in dealing with some of these issues. Why was it hard for you to do that at the time?
I think there's a combination of reasons. I mean, I am the oldest. I'm the only girl. I was sort of the best situated financially and work-wise in the sense that I was a freelance writer, so my schedule had flexibility. So there were certain natural family dynamics that pushed me in that direction. And then there were the cultural situation, which is that the daughters are expected to be the people who do this. And my mother actually said to me at one point, thank God I have a daughter. Sons are useless. and so I think, and then there was just the nature of our own particular family. And I think our culture too really says, live and let live. Don't impose your morality on other people. And so a lot of us now have a reflex of never saying to someone, hey, this is your moral obligation. Step up. And in a way, I wish I had done that because I think actually both my brothers would have felt better if they had done more. You know, I think when this happens to a parent, you're no longer the adult child going, you know, gimme, gimme, gimme something for Christmas. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you're the one that has to give. And I think it would have actually helped my brothers to have just simply said to them, look, everything's changed now. You're the one that needs to give now. The problems you had with your parents will never be resolved. It's all over. The game is over. It's a different game now. And we are the givers and we're not the takers anymore.
Yeah, that is, you know, I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but it is sort of a seismic shift that has to happen.
Yeah. And it's part of our maturing. I think it's like a life passage that we're totally unprepared for. Yeah. We don't think it's going to happen to us, even mm-hmm. though it's happening to everybody. And it is an opportunity to really mature. I don't want to glamorize caregiving, especially day-to-day hands-on caregiving. Caregivers are politically powerless. They're culturally invisible. They need a hell of a lot more support than we're giving them. So I don't want to glamorize it. And people mm-hmm. get broken and their health gets broken by it. But at the same time, it is an opportunity to mature and to move into this, I don't know, a riper stage of life. I feel my mother's death was a very, very inspiring death because she was so brave. She faced everything. She was so realistic. She had a couple heart attacks right at the end, and she was taken to a hospice unit, in inpatient hospice unit, and she said, I want to take off my earrings. I want to get rid of all the garbage. And she, you know, it's naked we come into the world and naked we will return. Mm. And I'm actually wearing those earrings right now, the same earrings. And I feel like the way she faced her death and the way she faced the burden of caregiving of my father will teach me for the rest of my life in ways that I can't even fully articulate now.
We just have a few seconds left, about 30 seconds, but I wonder if you can briefly talk about how your practice of Buddhism helped you through this process.
Well, I'm a Buddhist, a converted Buddhist. I was raised as an Anglican. One of the primary founding myths of Buddhism is that the Buddha went out from the jeweled palace and saw old age, sickness, and death, and were shocked by them. He saw an old man, a demented man, and a corpse. And he came back and said, I have got to understand the nature of life and the meaning of life. And then he went off and meditated. So Buddhist practices tend to bring up this question of being aware of the reality that everything changes and that you lose everybody and everything that you ever loved at some point. And so I think acceptance is a very, very important spiritual skill to develop. And the West had these traditions too, and we lost them in the 1800s, and we can regain them.
The new book by Katie Butler is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
This was an absolute pleasure, Chris. Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy, podcast produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.